Hi, I'm David Sanborn, and this is As We Speak. I continue my conversation with Pat Metheny about his new record, Dreambox, his creative process, and so much more.
There's one kind of major element of music that is impossible to quantify, and I'm talking not, I mean, obviously the issue of soul and consciousness and spirit and all that, that's way off in the impossible to quantify area. But there is a tangible aspect of music that is also impossible to quantify, and that's the issue of melody. And to me, it's like that aspect of things, you can't even break it down, really. It's just something that has to have a certain, it's almost like it's not even the notes, it's the glue between the notes that makes it add up to the feeling of what a melody is. And of course, Ornette was the giant of all time of that. I mean, he just couldn't not do that. And to me, there's a couple other people that were like that. Wes Montgomery was that. Lester Young is that. Stan Getz.
Oh, my gosh.
Gary Burton is that. It's kind of confusing with Gary because there's all these mallets flying around and all this stuff. But in terms of the continuity of melody playing, you know, that thing is just rare. It's really hard to get. And of course, you are that too, David. I mean, well, you know, that solo, like the thing you play on that Carly Simon, you belong to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's one thing to be able to play like 97 choruses of Stablemates and keep it going. It's a really other thing to be able to play a great 8-bar solo. And to me, they should not be mutually exclusive. If you could do one, it seems like you should be able to do the other. Wes was like that. Just the way he played the melody was like, you know, would kill you. You know, Miles was like that. And to me, this all kind of breaks down to, you know, this unmentionable aspect of music. And there are plenty of people who play kind of melodically, but to me, that's not the same as somebody who can really generate melody. And, you know, for me, that was always something. And, you know, it can be Schoenberg. It can be Stravinsky. It can be Bach. It can be Cecil Taylor. All to me are examples of people who, you know, I'm not talking about melody like, you know, sing-songy. I'm talking about what makes a melody do the thing that melodies do. And that to me has always been rarer, and that has always been a mission for me to try to, even in the most dense kinds of settings, to be able to invoke that spirit of melody.
Well, there's a certain sense of inevitability when somebody, you know, like whether it's an improviser or a composer, you know, it's unexpected, but then it's also inevitable. Well, yeah, of course they went that way. Yeah. It's like almost like making it look easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you got to come up with that. You got to think.
You just hit it right on the head there. It's that mix of inevitability and surprise that then has to reconcile itself in such a way that if you just go, you don't even question it. It's like you just go, yeah, well, that's right. And, you know, that's, I'm not even sure that's something you can necessarily
teach,
like, aim for. Well, I don't know about teaching. You can certainly point it out to people. I mean, I have spent a lot of time with musicians talking about that as in my case, a major goal. But I also know that there are times if I try for that, I'm not sure I can guarantee I'm going to get to it. It's sort of, you just have to be aware of that as a destination. And, you know, one other thing for me is that I've always felt like, you know, there is no other standard other than like Bach and Miles and Train. And, you know, to me, it's like there are very clear markers to aspire to, you know. And I mean, back to the thing of me not necessarily caring what anybody thinks, It's only that, you know, there aren't many people around who are thinking in those terms. They're thinking more like, well, how does this sound relative to the guy sitting next to me, or the guy down the hall, or the guy in LA, or what so-and-so thinks, or whatever. You know, to me, it's like, well, I mean, you know, the only thing that really matters is that there once, you know, walked on the planet musicians who were really dealing with music with an understanding of it that is very clearly represented in the output of what they've done as musicians. Yeah. I mean, you know, Herbie is that, you know, Keith Jarrett is that. Keith is that, you know, Ron Carter is that. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people, you know, that you can just say, well, that, like that, you know, Brad is that, you know, it's like I, Brad, and I go, yeah, like that.
Yeah, right. So, sometimes your path and your where things lead are not necessarily comfortable in the complete sense of the word. And I think that's not only important that you follow it, but it's essential that you, and sometimes it's letting go of stuff that, oh, I don't really want to, but you got to let it go, you know, and it doesn't have anything to do with tunes that, you know, like I can never play that song again. It's not about that. Just that I can't play just like that anymore, because I know this now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know I've heard countless musicians say, like Miles said, you know, people would ask him, how come you don't do another record like blah, blah, blah? He said, I can't play that way anymore. Mm,
yeah.
And it was just that answer is like, it's much more complex than what the words say. It's not, I can't play that. It's not, I'd love to, but I can't. It's no, that's then. It's like, I was doing that then, I'm doing this now. And that's what matters. And that's what, you know, if you look at it through the wrong lens, that can be terrifying, because it's not, you know, you're out there, you know, you're out there doing it. But, you know, going back to what you said about yourself in junior high school, is like, you don't care what other people think. And I know what you mean by that. It's not that you don't want to relate to people, is that that can't be an arbiter of what it is that you play. You know, I mean, I assume, and I have this feeling now, it took me a long time to get there, where I have to play what I play, and I hope people like it, but I can't do anything about that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, do you think that that's, in a sense, an accurate way of looking at things?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing also, you know, now with the benefit of, you know, hanging around for a long time and having a completely different perspective on things. And, you know, kind of a key thing for me that is, you know, just sometimes I wonder about, it's like when I first started making records, Bright Size Life, I'd only been a musician for 4 or 5 years at that point. You know, now it's like 50 plus years. Yeah. And I play like 100 times better now than I did then in every way. And I know a lot more about a whole lot of things now than I did then. And at the same time, the basic arguments of what kind of was laid out on Bright Size Life sort of still work for me. I mean, it's like, you know, I still can play pretty much every tune on that record and have something to talk about within the framework of that. And, you know, to me, I've always felt like, I've described it as like, I've been kind of building this house across all these years. And the core of the house is like Bright Size Life. And really, I've just kind of been adding on wings along the way, but that's the fundamental thing. And, you know, at the time Bright Size Life came out, I remember getting the first royalty statement, and I think it was 600. And then I remember, and they back then, you would do it country by country. And I remember thinking, You know, I saw on there that in Australia it had sold one, and I thought, well, I should at least write the guy a letter or something and thank him, you know. But where I'm going with that is, then like 25 years later, it seemed like people started talking about Brightside's life, because at the time they did not. You know, it was not, it wasn't a big thing when it came out at all. And, you know, then, you know, I mean, a couple of years ago, this was one of the many late life shockers. You know, Brightside's life is in the Smithsonian, in the, or the, you know, National Archives top, you know, 100 records of the 20th century or something like that. And I was like, wow, man, you know, that guy in Australia, he was on it, man. He was.
He was a sage.
He knew it. But no, I guess my point is, really, you don't know. Nobody knows.
And
all you can do is do your thing and be honest and try to make a statement about how you feel and how you think and what you hope to achieve within the realm of music with as much spirit and clarity and soul and all that stuff as you can. And then after that, you know, whatever happens is what it's going to be. You know, I saw recently Dave Binney out in LA. I don't know if you follow Dave Binney much, but
the saxophone player.
Yeah. He's unbelievable, man.
He's unbelievable.
He is unbelievable. He's been unbelievable for a long time.
Forever.
He makes unbelievable records.
Yes.
And I mean, he made a quintet record a couple of years ago with young LA guys, because he lives out there. And man, I mean, I don't know what else anybody would have to do. It's killing. And, you know, I don't know that there was a big article about it in some newspaper or anything. I kind of don't think there probably was. But, you know, what I tell Dave Binney is, hey, don't worry about it, man, because I promise you, nobody else is going to ever be able to do that. You did it. And so, you know, that's kind of more the way I think about stuff, is you just got to do your thing and you know, hope for the best. And also you have to accept, if your thing is knocking down garbage cans down 20 flights of stairs and transcribing it for orchestra, your thing is going to probably have a somewhat challenging place in today's culture. But on the other hand, if that's what you hear, you should definitely do that. And there is a way to transcribe trash cans going down 20 flights of stairs that could be really hip too. So
and you know, who knows, you know, it's history is almost, you know, writes its own. Who's to say what music is going to last, what art is going to last, you know, and the stories, you know, it's almost like a cliche to say, well, you know, Van Gogh never sold a painting in his life. You know, he never, you know, he starved and, you know, boom, there he is, you know, $250 million for a painting now. Not that that's a measure of the value of something, but the fact that Van Gogh is revered now and, you know, I mean, I'm trying to think of other people, Don Byas, you know, the great tenor player, absolutely. And all these great players, you know, that didn't get their due, and even to a certain extent, Lester Young. I mean, the equation was a little bit different back then, because jazz had currency in the culture much more than it does now, because it was popular music. But you know, who's to say what music is going to live on? What's the value of it? And the value of it to me is just the honesty of the expression, and you know, the fact that somebody's being to thine own self be true, you know, is being true to themselves. And they're, you know, I choose to believe that honesty and authenticity, and you know, to yourself and what you have to say, because what we're doing is we're expressing our point of view about the world through our music. And whether or not that's valid is not for us to decide. You know, we just do it and try to, you know, I know that for me, if I listen back to something that I've done and I say, that's the truth that I felt at that time. This really works just because all the elements, the conversation the musical conversation that's going on in the tune, you know, is this what I set out to do? And, you know, oftentimes that's the stuff that lasts. It's certainly for me, stuff that I go back to. But on another level, you don't ever know, you know, and it just kept, you just keep doing it. You just keep cracking it out because it feels good, number one. And it's just, it's enriching the way creating art is. Mm. You know, it's very personal.
It's funny, you said the to thine own self be true one too.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's funny, I hadn't really thought about it, but that was something my dad used to say a lot. So, you know, I probably got that, you know, kind of drilled into me early, you know. So
yeah.
Yeah, like that. And you also used a really interesting word that's gonna have some I think significant aspects to it coming up as we enter what is about to be a pretty wildly different set of possibilities in terms of the tools that we have. Use the word authenticity. And, you know, we, meaning improvising musicians, are weirdly, incredibly well placed in terms of our skill set and our, you know, interests and our, you know, sort of aspirations to understand as we enter into the realm of AI, because those things are not going to be able to be, what's the term they used, scraped off the internet. You know, like somebody could just generate random chord changes and, you know, we could stand up there and play different stuff every night, you know, and also it wouldn't be just okay. It would be something. And, you know, that puts us in kind of a unique spot in terms of the perspective that we can offer to that realm, but also what makes it, I think, have value or hopefully to have value would be, in fact, everything that it takes as an individual to get to the point of being able to express in a fluent kind of way as an improviser material that you are coming up with for the first time, whether it's on something you know or something you're just being presented with spontaneously, that has meaning to who you are. And, you know, man, it's hard to think of anything else quite like that as we go into this next zone here. So, yeah, I mean, I'm already thinking about that stuff. Like, you know, we're going to have some really interesting new tools available to us soon. And I have no fear of any of that stuff. Part of it is because, you know, being an electric guitar player, my first musical act was plugging it in. So, you know, I've been dealing with chords and wires and tech as part of my instrument, the same way you deal with reeds, you know. It's part of my thing. So, you know, I've always had a kind of natural connection to the tech side of things. Yeah, it's, you know, the thing of somebody being that one person, like, you know, you just say the word, you say the name, Joe Henderson. We get this sound in our mind. It's a whole world opens up. You know, you say the name, you know, Sonny Rollins. And you don't even have to, it's just the universe opens up of Sonny Rollins. That's something very unique. And, you know, I feel like, you know, as difficult as it is to be a musician, and it's probably underreported how hard it is to aspire to the kinds of things we're talking about. I mean, it's an incredible way to live a life because we are dealing in something that's fundamentally true. And by that, I mean, you know, B-flat was B-flat yesterday. It's going to be B-flat tomorrow. Yeah. It was B-flat a million years ago, if you could, you know, get something to vibrate at that pitch. And it'll be B-flat a million years from now. And, you know, it's that when I say it's true, we are trading in a currency of something that is fundamentally true. And that's an unbelievably privileged way to exist. However, it's also really hard. It's really hard to truly understand what music is and how it works. And I mean, you know, for me, the only people I really can relate to on at the level we're talking about, which is why I'm glad I'm talking to you, is other musicians. And this is not to necessarily negate the value of anybody else, but it's only musicians that really know this, you know, the challenge of understanding and what we all have to go through 24 hours a day to not just maintain what we've got, but hopefully, you know, to keep adding on to the house, you know, to the fundamentals of it.
It's living in that space. It's, you know, it's like, you know, you're always practicing. I'm always practicing. I'm always putting together things in a certain way that has the framework of music. Now, it you know, it can be something as obvious as a song structure or a series of melodies or vibrations, you know, because we're on a, you know, molecular level, we're just moving air, you know. So if you want to really break it down, we're in the moving business. You know, we're moving air at different speeds.
That's good.
I fell in love with just the vibration of the reed. Just that sound, that because you got this piece of wood that's vibrating at different speeds all the time. And it's like the voice, it's like the vocal cords. And there's endless ways to combine and recombine that. You know, you arrive at it in a different way, but fundamentally it's a vibration of the string. All these players sound different. And it's not just the choice of notes, it's the sound that they make, the sonic aspect of it. And you have a sound.
I love the concept of we're in the moving business. That's a new one for me. And I'm plan on using that, David.
Please do.
I will give you credit for it, but that's a new way. That's a really good way to discuss it. And you know, you being a wind instrument player and particularly a reed player, you have a immediacy in terms of the connection that you have with the creation of the things you're moving around that is the envy of all of us rhythm section players, that all of us attempt to do our best to emulate. You know, that's before we even get to the part about breathing. And your relationship sonically is an exact recreation of your relationship of breathing. And that's something that is really important, I think, for non-wind instrument players, whether they're drummers, bass players, piano players, vibes players, to have a sense of. In my case, I started as a trumpet player.
Right.
So even I don't even exactly notice it, but it's been pointed out to me that before I play anything, I go, and then when I run out of breath, I stop. And you know, I've felt like that was good. It was good that I was apparently a terrible trumpet player according to everybody, but I do have a sense of that. But there's one little funny thing I'm going to put in here regarding where you went with it all, that to me was just fascinating to experience. So the great piano player Paul Bley, Jaco and I started playing with Paul when neither one of us had really done much of anything on a so-called national level. This is years before he joined Weather Report or we did Bright Size Life or any of that. Paul hired us. And you know, Paul was an interesting kind of eccentric guy. And one day at a rehearsal, he pulled me over. He said, "What instrument do you play?" And of course, I'm standing there with a guitar on. And I'm like, guitar? He's like, no, you don't. And I'm like, well, and then he pointed at the amp. He said, what about that? That's all I hear. And he had a point. So I'm like, well, okay, I guess I play the amp then. And he said, no, you don't. And then he went over to the amp and he pulled it away from the wall, unplugged it, and pointed at the electrical socket. And he said, that's what you're playing, which is actually true. That me, Jim Hall, Wes, you know, Eric Clapton, all of us are really, I mean, in terms of what the audience is hearing, they're hearing us doing this stuff with these various accoutrements to create the vibration, as you talked about, to move it through the air, that is basically us manipulating that electrical, you know, plug. So that's far out. Now, okay, so that's a little parenthesis thing. To back to my thing for a minute, what is a thing, though, is that I also play a lot of acoustic guitar, and I play the guitar synth. And, you know, I've had at least 10 wildly different electric guitar sounds over the years, and there's baritone guitars and 12 strings and, you know, all this different stuff. And at the same time, it's been pointed out, and I think it's probably true, that most people, regardless of any of those things, can tell that it's me playing. Yes. in all of those different situations. And that, to me, really gets to what we're talking about here, which is the issue mm-hmm. of conception. Because to me, the way you hear stuff before you touch an instrument, your conception of sound, your conception of expression and of soul and all the things that make us musicians kind of has to happen before you touch an instrument. Yes. And usually it develops in parallel with your skills on an instrument. But, you know, it kind of has gotten to the point for me, and this is a weird thing to say, but it's something that comes from 50 plus years now, is it's starting to now kind of filter across into a whole other zone where, you know, I always thought it was about music, but now I'm starting to see, well, maybe music is just a symptom of something else, you know? And that to me is like when it really starts to get interesting. And when I think about, you know, the models that all of us, I think, share of Train and Bach and the really highest level musicians that all of us, you know, in our dreams aspire to even get to be a fraction of that. They all eventually somehow transcend music itself into this other thing that is built on their conception of what it is to be a person, what it is to be a human in this sort of complex ocean of possibilities and just, you know, all the pesky stuff of what happens when we die that we all have to deal with, yeah. All that stuff. We have to kind of make our way through this sort of swamp and forest of all these things with music sort of kind of as our best possible compass to help with all that. But, you know, you start to look past what all that is, and that's when it starts to get really interesting. And, you know, I think about that too, is that how somebody conceives of what they want to sound like, and where is that in the chain of achievement? I mean, does that have, it's kind of a you know, chicken and egg kind of thing, you know? And I know it's been that way for me too. There have been times a new instrument has inspired me to get to something that maybe I hadn't thought of before. But then there's other times when it's like, man, I have to get some skills in this area to sort of represent what it is that I am hearing, that I'm my conception of what something might be. So it's all fascinating. Again, part of what the amazing privilege of being a musician offers us.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, there's certainly, I think the older that I get, I'm more and more humbled by how vast this is. And try to separate the ego aspect of it. It's like, oh, I'll never get there. I'll never find. Yeah, but it's not about that. It's about the process of this journey and having the great gift of being able to represent that in sound, in music, as like, this is my journey. You know, and I'm getting more to the place that you were in junior high school, where I don't care what other people think, you know, and I look to me, the models are, you know, certainly John Coltrane, even as great a musician as he was, the fact that his evolution through his music, through his final, you know, records, which is all I have to know about his journey. But they get, you know, from Love Supreme on, you know, and the Live Elvis Impressions and all that, and then Ascension, and which was, I mean, incomprehensible to me when I first heard it. And I listened to it not long ago, and I thought, yeah, okay. And Interstellar Space, and all these records that nobody ever talks about, nobody ever thinks about. This was this man's journey. And it has, you know, it has validity. It has, you know, it's the truth. It's not just bullshit. You know, this was his journey. And if nothing else, John Coltrane was a truth teller, yeah. You know, and the fact that he made these records that, you know, maybe in one sense, we're not ready to hear. But it was an honest reflection of his journey, and that to me is something I hold up as a, you know, standard. Not necessarily okay, I'm going to go that way, but it was like being honest about it, and just being, you know, this is, you know, in one small way, it's like, you know, what's the relationship of sound and silence, you know. That's a meditation that I'll never get to the end of. Yeah. When is it, you know, when is it sound and when is it silence? And when do you, you know, that's 10 years of graduate school right there. You know, how do you deal with that? And it's like you deal with it with a sense of joy. And it's like, oh my God, I have all of this stuff that I can explore. It's like F.A.O. Schwartz all of a sudden. You're in the middle of this, you know, candy land. And it's like, God, I'm so lucky to have this. Yeah. And I don't have to explain it to anybody. You know what I mean? I can make records. I can do this. I can do that. But in the end, I'm going to just keep doing this anyway. Well, yeah. You know, and the fact that I was able to make a living this long is like, wow, that's great too. I don't know exactly how to ask this question, but I know maybe a way into it would be, I know you've talked about, I heard you talk about the idea of jamming is kind of over because everybody has an iPhone, and every moment that you live on this planet as a person who's known or when you're ever in a public situation where you're playing, you're being recorded every moment. And that sense of privacy of just, you know, working things out seems certainly compromised, if not over. I mean, do you have are your feelings about that the same that they were? I think I heard this interview was from a few years ago.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say that, you know, I mean, I was like a jam session guy. I'd always, you know, whenever we'd go around and play gigs, you know, and there was a jazz club, I would love to go sit in and play and hang with the cast. And, you know, it was always fun to do that. And then I can almost remember literally when it happened. You know, it was around the time that Brad and I did that record. So in the early 2000s, where it just suddenly became impossible because every time you would do anything, people would either, I mean, at that point, it wasn't even phones. It was everybody had like video cameras and stuff. And yeah, it takes the fun away for, because it's not a, you know, a spontaneous intimate thing. It's a world premiere, you know,
yeah.
and, you know, heaven forbid you miss the, you know, the third change on Stablemates, you know,
easy to do.
Gonna be forever. But again, I mean, that's just the way stuff has on. But, you know, talking about jam sessions, though, there is a related thing to what this album is, that talking about the Dreambox album, which is, you know, over kind of another area for me of interest of these last couple of years has been, because I was such a beneficiary of, you know, older musicians hiring me and giving me the opportunity to go on the road and play and stuff, that I kind of decided, okay, now, you know, it's the right time for me to do the same thing. And I've been doing this side eye thing with younger musicians. And now I'm on to the third version of it, which is we just are kind of in the middle of a record that I am so excited about. Now it's Chris Fishman, who's just an amazing all-around musician, Joe Dyson, who is, to me, after Antonio, I thought I was only going to get one dream drummer this time around. Turns out I get two, because Joe is the next one. So I've been playing with a lot of younger guys, and the way the whole process begins is that I invite them up to my pad, and we play tunes, just me and whoever, duo. And it's been mostly drummers. And we are in this incredible era of good drummers at the moment. And, you know, I mean, I never experienced that before. It was always hard to find a drummer, let alone how to choose between five or six great guys. But I record all of these kind of jam sessions with these guys. And we're mostly playing like, you know, Autumn Leaves and Stella and stuff like that. And then, you know, finally, you know, I want to hear him play a couple of my tunes, but it's all just guitar and drums mostly. And I have in that same folder hours and hours of that. And, you know, weirdly, I had never really heard myself play much other than in the studio, which was, you know, its own kind of trauma. And, you know, this is just kind of like what the Dreambox thing is. And it's sort of like, I really had no idea that that's what I sound like. And some of it is like, you know, I wonder if anybody else would want to hear this. So maybe someday there'll be a bunch of me and drummer duets coming out, you know, like, you know, with all these amazing drummers. I mean, I know you've had your life filled with trying to find drummers too. And I don't know if you're having the same, you know, cornucopia that I am right now of just one guy after the next who plays great. And it's exciting.
I had that for a while, and now I'm kind of in a lean period, because everybody that I enjoy playing with is working all the time on other stuff. Cause I don't go on the road as much as I used to. So I can't keep these guys working all the time, and they do other stuff. Yeah. You know, Emmett Cohen, Jeffrey Keiser, Ben Williams, who you played with. These great players are not, you know, I find myself in a situation of not being able to find, you know, cause I want to get together with the people. You know, I don't want to just call somebody cold and do it, because you don't know.
Yeah.
And because it's all about the chemistry.
Yeah.
It's not about the name. It's like, oh, this guy is great. Well, okay. It's like the same. It's like putting together an all-star band. Well, you don't know if it's going to work.
Yeah.
Because it's chemistry.
Yeah.
Man, I've taken up so much of your time.
And it's great talking, man.
It's really, really a pleasure to talk about so many things. And I mean, I've, you know, it's just great to talk to somebody who has that kind of open sense of, you know, like music being an open sky.
That's the Sonny Rollins quote that I think we all live by. You know?
Yeah, that's it. It never ends. Thank God.
This has been As We Speak, a podcast from WBGO Studios. This episode was produced by Trevor Smith. Billy Robinson is our executive producer, and the president and CEO of WBGO is Stephen A. Williams. I'm David Sanborn.